The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. And can you hear all right? Volume is good. Hello, everyone online who is watching. Welcome as well. And so, I want to bring up a fascinating topic. For me, at least. But a challenging topic for some of you. In fact, some of you might come up afterwards to me, Gil. You don't understand. Let me tell you how it really is. You're not taking something into account. So I do this talk with great risk. So the topic is the state of the world. Oh, God. That was a perfect comment given. The state of the world. And it elicits that phrase elicits a lot of responses to people. Some people have despair around the state of the world. Some people have a lot of anxiety about the state of the world. Some people have a lot of opinions about the state of the world. The topic of state of the world for some people elicits a lot of predictions, a lot of imagination, where we don't see the difference between predictions and actuality. Don't see the difference between predictions and what has to and will happen. And even to say that is challenging because of how strong the views are about this is actually what's going to happen. And this topic of the state of the world has been something I've been reflecting on the last few days because earlier this week someone presented this topic in a very open way as a topic for reflection. When you think of the state of the world, what arises for you? And it was obvious from some way some of you gasped or something. That something arises, just the topic of it. But for me, when this was brought up, the context in which this topic of state of the world was brought up was kind of unique. By that time, I'd spent maybe 5 days or so, 4 days, living outdoors, really outdoors, sleeping on the ground, with the open sky above me, kind of. There were trees, canopy, a little bit over me. I could see the stars, though. And I'd spend much of the day sitting in this meditation posture on the ground, surrounded by a community of 9 large trees. And being at this level, the ground was really close. It was kind of special. And where I was sitting, the ground was uneven, so I had to kind of always taking it into account. And there was a gentle slope in the ground. It was kind of a grassy ground, dry California grass. Gentle slope going uphill. So when I looked out, you know, clearly the ground was right there to look at. And because I was sitting so low, mostly what I was aware of were the trees, besides the shade they provided, was their trunks. Big trunks that were stable and strong and had been there for many years. I'd been there before, the same kind of situation for a week. And there were some wild and difficult things that happened in that grove of trees. But the stability and the strength of these trees is there, and the solidity of the ground that we're sitting on was phenomenal. So in that context, someone brought up for reflection the state of the world. And my first thought was, which world is she talking about? There are so many worlds that we live in. Is the word, but the word, the interesting English word "world," just like in the Buddhist language Pali, they have the word "loca," which doesn't it kind of mean like crazy in Spanish? Well, that's just a coincidence. But the word "loca" has the different reference points, just like the English word "world" has. It can, some people, just means the earth, but it's not the physical earth usually. It's everything that's in this earth, not just the physical earth. Is it the human world? Some people limit it to the human world. Is it the animal world? We maybe use that expression, the animal world, and we refer to a certain subsection of this earth that we live in. Is it the political world? Some people, when they hear the state of the world, they think politics. It's like the state of American politics. And people have been going, some of the people, ever since I was aware of American politics. I think the first big thing that I was aware of in my lifetime, I was a little bit aware of the Nixon-Kennedy election. And as a little kid, I was mostly preferred the person who had the nicer name. And that's all I knew. But then a few years later, it was a big impact to be in school, elementary school. It's probably third grade or something. And had the teacher send us home because President Kennedy had been assassinated. So, the state of politics. And as elicited, you know, maybe forever, as long as it's been politics. Or is the world the environmental world? And what's happening, the very difficult things happening, the destruction of the environment, the climate, is that what we refer to as the world? What is the world we live in? So I was sitting there wondering about this, and because I was sitting on the ground, I thought, what's the state of the world from the point of view of the mountains? They're kind of solid. They come and go too, but the mountains have been there, stable and strong for so long. And the weather comes and goes. The seasons come and go. The dinosaurs come and go. All kinds of things. The mountain, from the point of view of the mountains, what is that like? The world. What is the state of the world from the point of view of the oceans? I love oceans. And I spend a lot of time on the surface or the edge of the surface of waters. And I marvel at when I go to the Pacific coast here and watch the waves come in and wash across this temporary wave washes up on the sand and then it washes out over and over and over again. I say, wow, it's been doing this for a long, long time. I'm seeing a scene here that I could have seen 100,000 years ago, someplace on this planet, or a million years ago, or 100 million years ago. I could have seen this. And the oceans, point of view of the oceans, I've seen so much coming and going, and ups and downs. And in my hometown in Norway, there's a mark on the, I don't know exactly where it is, but there's a marker that says that in the year 1200, the water level of the town, Bergen, it's a bay, and the water level from the ocean was here. It was far above where it is now. Less than 1,000 years ago, was it really the ocean go up and down that much? Was it tide? What was it? I was kind of marveled at this. Where is the ocean, and how does it change over these years and centuries and millennia and millions of years? And what state are you, the ocean that comes and is there and sees so much change? And what's the? And is it reasonable to ask these questions from those perspectives? The reasonable is that, for me at least, is that it kind of highlights. The perspective I might use when I have this word state of the world. And it kind of puts it, contextualizes it. Oh, it's a particular state, a particular viewpoint that I'm using. Is it the only viewpoint? Is it the best point of view to say this is the state of the world in any given moment? I marvel at the redwood trees we have here in California. There were some of these nine trees that surrounded us were redwood trees. And apparently redwood trees are the among the very oldest species of life on this planet of ours. You know, things come and go, right? But apparently the species of redwood trees that we have here are 100 million years old as a species. That's phenomenal. 100 million years. So humans haven't been around that long. And what have the redwood trees seen in 100 million years of coming and going and the here and there? It's phenomenal what's happened. And if you ever want to study tectonic movement of tectonic plates on this planet, it's fascinating. I grew up thinking I took the Earth for granted. This is how it is. Seven continents, and you know, this is what. But the continents have come and gone over billions of years. There's continents that have funny names that no longer existed and didn't have names then. And so this, you know, and so the redwood trees have seen so much. It's phenomenal. So what is the state of the world? And more importantly, perhaps, what is our relationship to the state of the world, to the world? And there are people who their relationship to the state of the world is that they are victims. And that's the primary orientation they have. Some people, the relationship to the state of the world is they are responsible for it. And so it's like a big deal. I get a sense that some people feel personally responsible. Like it's up to them to solve the world. Someone this week, last week talked about some of that might come from the myths, the West, kind of the myths that somehow have been spread into, embedded in kind of many cultural views or subcultural views of the hero's journey, which is a very individual journey. Like, you have to be the hero, and it's up to you alone to do it. And so I'm responsible, you know, to do something. Is the perspective in which we relate to the state of the world, are we consumers of it? It's just for me to consume, to have more experiences, to have more things, to have more comfort, to more, you know, just that's the orientation. Is the perspective we have towards the state of the world to have power and dominion over it, to be have authority and be in control, and you know it's all mine, and I'm gonna, you know, and there are people, individuals who have that kind of view, and maybe even cultures have had that view, and maybe even worldviews that have been passed down to the generations that you know we have some kind of it's us to have power and authority over this world, and. So are we consumers? Kind of the opposite of consumers could be, are we producers of this world? What does it mean if we're the producer of the world? Is that like a crazy concept? Producers of the world. Are we stewards of the world? Are we participants of the world? Are we the state of the world? So all, I think, for me, there's all these very important questions to ask. From the point of view of the Buddha, I'd like to suggest that he saw us as the producers of the world in a funny way, in a unique way. That there's a way that the world, there are a lot of origin stories of the world, right? Different cultures, religions down through time. All these wonderful, interesting, fascinating creation stories of the world. Many of them embed in them a lot of wisdom. And that's, you know, people are making up myths for, you know, ever since they could make language or something. And those myths are fascinating. Some of them are really wise and interesting, but creation myths. And Buddhism has one too, but that's, we don't need that right now. But the Buddha, it's more his point of view, is more like the creation myth is that the world begins in each of us. It's born in each of us, maybe moment by moment. Now, why is that important? Why would the Buddha say this? And of course, it's kind of crazy, right? I mean, certainly this planet once upon a time was just, I don't know, just molten lava that just, there wasn't even water on it. And, you know, and so we have this growth and development of this planet. And so how could it just be born right now? But remember, the word world is this creative word. It's kind of, it's not, you know, it's not the earth. What is the world? So if it's a flexible word, fluid word, then what does the Buddha mean when he said that we're the, he didn't literally use this word, but implied that we're the producers of the world. So there was a man who came to the Buddha, and he said, you know, in this town here, there's people who are your followers, but they would have a lot more faith in you and your teachings if you would send some monk into town to perform miracles. You know, that impresses people. Some people like miracles are what gets them into some religions back. So the more miracles you do, the more followers you get. So, you know, so the Buddha said no. He wasn't going to do that. Command a monk. The language in Pali is command. Command a monk to go do miracles. No. So the man asked again. And the Buddha said no. And there's something in India, ancient India at least, that about if you ask something three times, it's pretty significant. And you really have to take a person seriously now. And sometimes you can't say no if someone asks three times or something like that. So the man asked the Buddha a third time. And so the Buddha neither acquiesced, he didn't say yes, he'd do that, and he didn't refuse the third time. Instead, he said, there are three kinds of miracles. There's the miracles that arise from meditation practice, the miraculous kind of wonders that the mind can see. There's the miracle those things are not an important part of the story. But he, and then he goes on to say, there's the miracle of instruction. The miracle of instruction. Imagine that. The instructions a teacher might give. How's that a miracle? And then he goes on to explain the miracle of instruction. It's the miracle of instructing people how to focus their thinking, what to think about. The miracle of instructing people how to not just think, but to really have some deeper contemplation, creative contemplation, a generative kind of thinking. And then there's the miracle of teaching, instructing people to what to let go of. That's a nice thing, right? Not to let go, but what to let go of. And then there's the miracle of teaching people, instructing people what states of mind to states of heart to enter into and rest in. There are certain states of being that are really useful and valuable to be in. And so meditation practice, Buddhist practice, points to this. And it's not just simply doing practices, but to do the practices that open the door to different inner states of how to be in this world. And to enter those doors and to rest in those, to abide in it, is the language. Those are miracles. So isn't that great? That's the miracle. So send a monk into town and perform miracles. Well, that's send them into town to teach. So anyway, so Buddha says this, response to this person. And as he often does, when he kind of dismisses these kind of miracles ideas, but then he accommodates the person by coming up with what I call a myth that he tells. And to somehow maybe kind of go along with the person's mindset, how they see things, what they want, kind of go along with them, and then turn the table on them. Kind of, you know. So he starts off by saying, well, once upon a time, long, long ago, there was a monk who wanted to know where earth, fire, wind, earth, water, fire, and wind, where they end. Where do they end? And that's supposed to be, that refers to the whole physical world that we live in. Where does that physical world we experience, where does it end? And part of the reason they would ask this in ancient India is that there was people back in ancient India who were deeply dismayed, upset, scared, aversive to how difficult this world was. This world is a difficult, painful place to be. And the only way out is to transcend it. There is to somehow, especially when you die, to go to some good place. To go to some place where this world ceases to exist, that we live in. So exactly what that place is it a place? Some people believed in a place, kind of a heavenly realm in ancient India, or kind of not quite like our heavenly realm in the West often we have, but you know, there's this idea of transcendence, like you want to leave this world because it's just too difficult. You know, there's no hope here. So those people that probably, if you said, I'm going to bring up, talk about the state of the world, probably, yeah, well, that's going to be heavy talk, difficult talk, you know, because they're going to talk how terrible it is. And the point is to kind of get off this. So that's one of the languages of transcending is to go to where the earth, water, fire and wind cease. So the monk goes to find someone who can answer this question. Where does this cease? He finds some great sage and says, well, you have to go ask some of the gods. And so he goes, travels up to the god realm and asks one god, and no, you have to go to the higher realm god. And no, you have to go to ask the higher realm god. And he keeps going to the higher realm gods, and he comes to the highest god in the Indian pantheon at the time, which was Brahma. And he goes to Brahma and says, Brahma, where does earth, water, fire, and air, wind cease? And Brahma says, I am the great Brahma, the all-knowing, the all-powerful, the wise, luminous Brahma. So the guy asks the question again, and Brahma says the same thing. You know, I'm the greatest. Well, you remember three times, right? So the guy asks Brahma again, and Brahma gets down from his throne, takes him by the elbow, come over with me. And he kind of goes over, talks privately, and says, you know, the other gods here think that I'm all-knowing. You know, and I can't really, you know, but I don't really know the answer to your question. And I can't admit it. So it's kind of Buddhist humor. And so they go, and somebody said, there's a, who you should ask the Buddha. So the guy goes back to the earth, to the Buddha, I guess it was maybe even his teacher, and asked the Buddha, where does this cease? And the Buddha said, long ago in my previous lifetime, I was a sage who looked for the end of the world. This is where the word ceases. I traveled every direction, forever and ever, in all directions. And no matter how far I traveled, I could travel like as fast as an arrow for 100 years at a time. And I never came to the end of the world. And you won't find a place where the earth, where the world ceases. And the earth, the world ceases, this world of ours, in your own body. This is the world where you find the cessation of, but you don't find the cessation of earth, water, fire, and air. It's the place where earth, fire, water, and air no longer have a footing. We no longer hold on to them. Where earth, the world that we live in, no longer has rooted itself in our consciousness, in our mind, in there. So it's not, we're not caught in it. It's still there, but it doesn't stick to us. So that's just a fascinating idea itself. And it's a place where knowing is no longer visible. Knowing has no limits, no boundaries, no edges. Where knowing is luminous all around, or clear all around. It's a fascinating kind of idea, knowing. So where knowing cannot be seen, and from the Buddhist point of view, knowing that can't be seen is knowing that is not attached to anything. As soon as the knowing has an attachment, then it kind of creates a kind of resonance or contraction or tightness or something that others can kind of tell. Sometimes you can see that when someone's concerned about something, like state of the world, oh! It's got them. You know, they're knowing something in their mind, and you can see now that their mind is caught by something. And so, you know, if someone is full of desire for something, you see them searching and wanting, you can feel, you can see that they're wanting something, or they're angry, or they're... So there's a way in which the state of our mind gets conveyed, and you can kind of pick it up in some subtle way. And the more sensitive the viewer is, the more sensitive we can pick up the subtlety of how people have gotten caught by an idea or involved in an idea. But when someone knows something and the knowing has no attachment in it, then there's no way of... You don't read the person's mind. You don't read how they are. There's a knowing which can't be seen. Knowing that's free. So this knowing that can't be seen. And knowing that it has no boundaries, no limit. There's a way the Buddha also felt that as soon as you're attached to something or you're stuck in some idea of things, you've created a limit to the world you live in. Now you define the world. The world is defined for you in a particular way. And there's a way of knowing that has no definition. There's no limit. And that kind of knowing has a kind of clarity, openness that he calls luminous, or it's like light, all around. So the mind, the knowing feels luminous and wonderful. So what kind of knowing is that? But you know, that's where earth, water, fire, and air, it doesn't cease. That's not the point. It's not the point to transcend it. The point is to find a place where it's rooted, where it's not rooted, the mind's not caught in it. That's an interesting idea. So here, this guy wants miracle, wants supernatural powers, wants a demonstration of it, and the Buddha says, no, that's not important. Instructions are what's important. And then he tells him this myth about supernatural powers, this guy going to the heavens and someone traveling to the edges of the world, and saying, no, that's not the way. And then he turns the table on the guy, turns it upside down, and says, you know, yes, you don't find it. He literally says to the guy, you're asking the wrong question. You don't ask the question, where does the world cease? Where does the world have no footing? Where does it not grab us? Where do we not get attached to it? And then he says, that happens where knowing is not seeable. Knowing is no limit. Knowing is luminous because there's no attachment. Somewhere else, someone also is asking the Buddha for miracles. And similar kind of story. And there the Buddha talks about, the person wants to ask, there asks literally, where does the world, the loka, where does it end? Where does it come to an end? And the Buddha reply there is that the world is this fathom-long body. So here now he's defining the world, this fathom-long body. And one of the things we see in the teachings of the Buddha, he keeps pointing the attention of a practitioner. It's very important to say a practitioner, someone who's really engaging in Buddhist practice. Not all about how we're in the world out there, but Buddhist practice, to the world of direct experience. So here and now, not because here and now is the God of Buddhism, but the here and now is the place that we're in touch with, literally, our direct experience, the senses, the five senses and knowing, here. And so this fathom-long body is this world of how we experience the world in the senses, here and now. And he said, it's here that we see the world, the arising of the world, the origination of the world, the ceasing of the world, and the practices that lead to the cessation of the world. And in this case, he kind of slides back and forth now between calling the world suffering, loka and dukkha. Dukkha is suffering. The world of, we know suffering, we know the arising of it, the origination of it, we know the ceasing of it, and the practice that leads to it. This world that is our phantom long body, that's where we produce the world. That's where the world begins for each of us. And in a radical way, indirect experience, not the imagination, not the memory, both of which have some uncertainty to them. Both of them would have some inaccuracy to them. They're all kind of predictive or imaginary. They belong to the world of the imagination often. Anything that's beyond our direct experience. But our direct experience always begins fresh and new every moment. The world is born here. And why I feel it's very important to say this is that the world you want to live in, the world you'd like to live in, if you're just waiting for everyone else to make that happen, you're going to wait a long time. And if you have the imagination of how horrible the state of the world is, chances are you also have imagination of what's possible, what could be wonderful. And if there is a possibility of a wonderful world to live in, don't wait for other people to make it. Be the maker of it. Your world, the world, your world begins with you. And you can be the producer of it. Be the person who is what you want the world to be. If the world is a place where people are kind to each other, friendly to each other, support each other, cooperate with each other, a world where people resolve their conflicts, be that way. Be kind, be friendly, be generous. Work on solving conflicts. Engage in that. Don't pass it on to others expecting others to do it. Because that's a world, if you do that, if that's the world you create, other people will do it. And I'm the consumer, I'm the victim, I'm this, you know. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's why it seems so real, because you're kind of producing the very thing that you're afraid of. But to be the producer of the world that's here, starts here. And then we can do it together with others. We find other people who are producing that kind of world. And there's a lot of people producing a good world out there. And phenomenal many people. There was a wonderful book some years ago that I saw, maybe from Anne gave it to me, maybe, that was celebrating how many small nonprofits there are in the world right now, small efforts in small little towns here and there and cities here and there are trying to address the climate change and the environmental issues of our times. And if you took sum total of all these little small efforts, it's phenomenal what it is. And New York Times today has an article about the exponential growth of alternative energy sources, and how there are also so many different small places that are doing it, and small governments. And so all that, you want to live in a world where we do collective efforts, not hero worship, hero worshiping, but worshiping our collective. Let it begin with you and find people to share with and work with. And then something beautiful is happening here. And who knows? The San Andreas Fault might shake. Any minute now. Yeah, some of you don't know, but a mile from here or so, maybe a little bit more, 2 miles from here, is a level of tension of two tectonic plates rubbing against each other and pressing against each other, and kind of because of the friction, not giving in yet, but at some point that pressure will be just enough, it'll go. And last time it happened in 1906, you can see up in some places where the ground shifted. You can still see it jumped and shifted away, and it's dramatic. So now you'll go home afraid, scared, because that's one way to address the state of the world, is to be frightened by it, to be a victim of it, to be under its sway. But to be the producer of the world, to cultivate the best qualities of a human being, so that when the San Andreas, equivalent of the San Andreas fault shakes, we're ready for that. We're ready for the beginning of a new world, of a new town, of a new state, of a new something. We're ready to bring forth the best qualities we have to contribute to what's new in a good way. And we see that happens many times in many places, that sometimes the level of tragedy that happens, that human cause, is caused by very few people. But how many people come together to address the issue? And so I'll end with one of the great American heroes who I don't think believed in the hero's journey, Mr. Rogers. Who said that, who attributed a lot of who he became to his mother. Because when he saw the terrible things happening in the world, he asked her about it, and she said, look around and look for the helpers, the people who are helping. And there's lots of people who are helping. Don't forget that. Don't be so overwhelmed by what's happening in the world. You don't see the helpers. Don't be so overwhelmed in the world that you don't become one of the helpers. That's what's important. That's the world we want to live in. There's so much uncertainty. But let's not be uncertain about the goodness of our own hearts. Let's be the producers of the world. Let's make it together into a place that's good. And I think that's the message of the Buddha. Here, you can be free. Here you can free yourself of your attachments. Here your heart and mind can become luminous. And here is where your kindness and compassion and care and generosity and wisdom and patience and equanimity can come and meet this world. Here, maybe even as soon as you get in your car to drive home, those of you who are driving, drive as if you're creating a new world. So, that's my thoughts today. So, thank you. So, I think today we have tea, right? Is that right? Yeah, so what it means is that there's maybe, is it all outside? So, it's been set up outside in the parking lot, so we can go out there and have tea and snacks and hang out and talk. And we have 5 minutes before the official ending of this talk. So what I'd like to ask of you, if you'd like, you don't have to, if you don't want to, or you don't have time for it. But if you could just turn to a couple of people next to you and say hello and just introduce yourself and welcome your person here. Even if it's your first time here, welcome the person. And just say hello and...